Blog Talk Radio.
March 27, 1961 is the moment that can be recognized as the beginning of the youth movement, and that did start with 9 young people who were enrolled here at Stephen Bennett Historic School of College in the state of Mississippi. This sparked the movement.
Had we not gone to the library and let it change on its own, I think we should be using the library cop, and I think the Eudora Library, Jackson Public Library, would be quite on the Jackson Municipal Library.
We didn't know if our life would be spared or our bodies would be broken.
All of us were willing to leave our lives on the line for the cause of civil rights. We shall overcome. We shall
ladies and gentlemen, welcome live on Tribe Family Channel. I am Beverly Black, and we are here to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the Tougaloo Nine, on March 27, 1961, nine college students walked into a Jim Crow whites only library, the main library in downtown Jackson, Mississippi. They walked into that library and breached the whites-only barrier that broke the chains. Now here we are, 60 years later. I am Beverly Black, and with me I have the leader of the Tougaloo Nine, Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. Good afternoon, good evening, sir, and congratulations to this momentous moment in civil rights history. Welcome to Tribe Family Channel. How are you this evening?
Ms. Black, I am just really overjoyed to have been able, at the age of 83, to celebrate this momentous occasion.
Wow. I have to say thank you, and it is an honor, a privilege, and a pleasure not only to know you as a member of the Tougaloo Nine and the leader of the Tougaloo Nine, but also I know you as a minister and as a friend. Hold on one second, please. We have another member of the Tougaloo Nine joining us. Ladies and gentlemen, alive here not only is Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. and myself, Beverly Black, but we have Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, one of the Tougaloo Nine, here with us also. Hello, Mrs. Hollis. Happy 60th anniversary. How are you this afternoon?
There is a phenomenal we are on, for this.
Oh, we're on the air. I wanted to tell you you're live on Tribe.
Okay.
Go ahead. I'm wow. Sorry.
Okay. A phenomenal word, and it spells A-W-E-S-O-M-E.
Congratulations, Queen. Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr., your colleague, I am so honored to have join us, is the one who stopped the show 4 years ago. She said, we got to find Joseph. Say hello to your colleague, Joseph.
Well, hello there, Mrs. Hollis. This really is a blast from the past. It's reminiscent of our excellent shows that you hosted and I co-hosted many years ago, I would say.
Wow.
So here we are once more bringing our story to the public regarding the history, civil rights history, I might add, of the Tougaloo Nine. So it's a pleasure to really come together again with you.
It's always awesome when we can find the time and the reason to come together, Mr. Jackson. And I think that you know that very well.
Yes.
Thank you.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it is safe to say that 60 years ago today, these two individuals were sitting in a Jim Crow jail at this time of the day. It is 5:09 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. That would make p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. So I'm confident in stating that fact, that these two, along with their other seven colleagues, were sitting in a Jim Crow jail in Jackson, Mississippi, because they walked into the Jackson Downtown Main Library, which was a whites-only library, bringing us to this point in time in history,
60 years later, how does that feel for you? We're going to play a clip from our libraries, no pun intended, but I am honored to stand on your shoulders and to have been a benefactor of your courage and your leadership. So, ladies first, Mrs. Hollis, take me back to that moment when you were getting trained by your great leader, the field secretary of the NAACP, all of Mississippi, and that would have been the late, great Megger Wiley Evers, who actually orchestrated through his genius military training and strategy to organize a sit-in and to train you all through mock protests, through subjecting you to treatment that you were bound to face as you approached the barrier that was put in place by Jim Crow. Ms. Hollis, you go first, please.
That was a very long time ago, but it does not take away from the depth of things that I felt. Duval, it was quite scary because we knew that we would be doing something that was against the nature and the requirements in the segregated state of Mississippi. The other thing was that it was exhilarating to be able to think that we could make a difference, that we could make some changes. So we went in there with those trainings, and when I do say trainings, we had to think about what would happen to us when we walked into that library. Would we be hit? Would we be hit with a billy club? Would we be pushed, or would we be handcuffed right away? Would we be called derogative names and all of those kinds of things, episodes of filthy names calling? So we didn't know just what we would be met with, but we knew how the conditions of that time were, and they were not easy, especially if you stepped forward to make a difference. If you could say yes, sir, no, sir, and move back or step back, then you were okay. But that was not our goal. Our goal was to step up and move forward. And that was a challenge to me as a person. But as an individual, I felt gratified that I was chosen through all of those things that I had to go through. And the feelings, those emotional feelings that were involved, and that I had this opportunity to make a difference.
And we thank you so very much for the courage that it took to step forward and make that difference. Thank you so much once again. Mr. Jackson.
Yes, Ms. Black.
The same question to you, please.
Well, actually, when I arrived on the campus of Tougaloo in the fall of 1960, I had already chosen to follow in the footsteps of the minister that I set as an example to want to be like, and that was Dr. Martin Luther King. Only because of his courage and his commitment to being able to successful to lead the Montgomery bus boycott there. I think it was in after Rosa Parks refused on December 1st to 1955 to give up her seat on a bus. So actually, following his history in terms of preparing himself and others, especially those that are in the community of Montgomery, Alabama, and explaining to them that when they decided to commit themselves to the Montgomery bus boycott, he just told them that some of them may end up losing their lives. So I followed along with his courage, but I also remember the earlier beginnings of Diane Nash and John Lewis when they were the first activists in Nashville to stage the first sit-in in that state. And they were trained in mock demonstration, nonviolence demonstrations under the tutelage of Reverend James Lawson. And so I pretty much knew of the mock demonstration with regards to nonviolence activity. So when I arrived at Tougaloo and being a minister and following in the footsteps of the man who I really wanted to be like as a minister, I came to Tougaloo with the experience of being a pastor of the Riverview Christian Church for a year and a half, 1959 through the spring of 60. And the moment I was really chosen to become a part of the NAACP Youth Council, and of course they elected me president, I was just ready to get involved in those mock demonstrations and whatever I had to face, even to the extent of laying my life on the line, I was ready. But I also had a wife and two children under the age of three. But I didn't think about that. All I wanted to do was get involved and to make a change with regards to the Jim Crow laws in the state of Mississippi, because I grew up in the South, maybe not the Deep South, but Memphis, Tennessee also adhered to the same Jim Crow laws as the other southern states. So whatever I could do to make a change for my people, I was ready for the mock demonstration.
Ooh, we thank you and salute you, as well as Mrs. Hollis, for your undying courage and the endurance through the mock demonstrations, and to push aside any fear or any thoughts of self-preservation so that people like myself, who not only have grown up enjoying the library, but I also brought my children up to have a duly amount of respect towards the library, towards having a card, towards checking out books, reading, ingesting knowledge, and for really having the accessibility to education that is self-driven. You pick out what you want at the library. You're buried into that book. You're ingesting this information. You're researching it. And just knowing how to matriculate your way around knowledge is key. All the knowledge is out there, but if you don't know how to get to it, then you're on the other side of it. So now we're going to take a listen to this 12-minute clip that is from the Rachel Maddow Show. And she is speaking on you all and the legacy of Mega Evers back in 2013. And I believe that this is around the time that mainstream started really getting a clue. So we'll listen to this, and then we'll have Mr. Jackson give words, and then you, Mrs. Hollis, on how it felt back then, because it was about a year later that we all began to interact on Tribe Family Channel, Voices of Wisdom, where you two were the host. And cannot even begin, I don't have the words to say what a phenomenal job and conversation that you two brought forth with all the gems that dropped. All I knew is that when the show was over, I was not letting go of y'all. So here we go, and y'all, forgive my California country grammar with y'all. I've never been to the South, but
okay.
I love y'all. So, ladies and gentlemen, live on Tribe Family Channel, honoring the 60th anniversary celebration of the Tuvalu 9, I am so honored and humbled, Beverly Black, here with the leader of the Tuvalu 9, Mr. Joseph Jackson, Jr., and Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, also host of Voices of Wisdom, excuse me. And you can find out more about the Tuvalu 9 at www.thetuvalu9.com and also www.backtomississippi.com. Here we go with Rachel Maddow bringing us history from 2013.
This is Belzona, Mississippi, and this picture was taken in 1939. It's an African-American man apparently going to the movies. You can see him there in the hat, right? See him sort of in silhouette. Below him, written on the side of the stairs outside the theater, it says, colored admission, 10 cents. Because this man is black in Belzona, Mississippi in 1939, he has to use a separate door, and he has to sit way up in the balcony. In Mississippi now, of course, and everywhere in the country, theaters are integrated, and today this man could sit anywhere he wants. But this particular theater is gone. There is no regular place to go see a movie in Belzona, Mississippi anymore. This is an attempt to buy lunch at a Woolworth's lunch counter in 1960 in Greensboro, North Carolina. This was the first of the 1960s lunch counter sit-ins. Today, in our more integrated country, Americans of any race could sit down and order, even take their time going over the menu in a place like this, except for the fact that that store, where those particular protesters wanted to eat back in 1960, that store closed a long time ago. Finally, a few years ago, a civil rights museum was able to open in what had been the long vacant old storefront from that Woolworths. And here we have another attempt to buy lunch, this time at a Woolworths in Jackson, Mississippi, the state capital. This was in 1963. This time the group included white people and African Americans sitting down together at that lunch counter in violation of both the unofficial social code and the official law, and bringing upon themselves the outrage and ridicule and abuse of the mob that gathered around them. Today, that same mixed race group could eat in that same Woolworths without fearing for their safety, because that place, like all American restaurants, would be an integrated restaurant now. They put a historic marker at that site just the other day, 50 years after the sit-in at that Woolworths in Jackson, Mississippi. But I say they put a marker at the site instead of at that store, because as you can see from this picture, the store is gone. In its place is a bunch of redeveloped stuff, including a parking garage. That old place with all the restaurants crowded around in that neighborhood, not just the Woolworths, that place is gone. The southern part of the United States did get forced to abolish its segregation laws. But it was a bloody, bloody fight. Throughout the old Confederacy, white people were asked first as a matter of conscience, and then finally they were ordered as a matter of justice to integrate on racial lines. And when the white people who had control of the laws and the government and the schools and the businesses, when the fight to hold on to segregation laws was a lost fight, and they knew they had no choice but to integrate the society that they lived in many cases, instead of going through with that and living through that kind of change, a lot of them just decided to quit that society. They gave up public pools and public schools and, in some cases, movie theaters. They gave up whole cities and moved away. They called it white flight, right? The census from 1960, for instance, records a Jackson, Mississippi that was majority white, almost 2-1. By 1990, Jackson's population had made the turn toward getting smaller, and it was getting much blacker. By 2010, Jackson, Mississippi had become the second most African-American city in the nation. White people in the previously legally segregated South, and really across the nation, abandoned places rather than see them change. But white people were not the only ones who moved away. From roughly the First World War through the 1970s, our country experienced what they call the Great Migration. That's a term that refers specifically in this country to a great migration of people whose parents and grandparents and great-grandparents were slaves in the South. Because even though slavery had technically ended as a lawful practice in this country, it was replaced in the South with sharecropping and Jim Crow segregation enforced by violence and by disenfranchisement. So all of those many descendants of slaves picked up and moved to the North for the relative, if imperfect, freedom to be found in places like Chicago and Oakland and Detroit and D.C. and New York. People who could leave left by the millions. 6 million African Americans emigrated out of the South in the Great Migration from the 19-teens through the 1970s. 6 million. In Isabel Wilkerson's History of the Great Migration, it's called The Warmth of Other Suns, she writes about how so many African Americans were leaving the South during that migration that white farmers and business owners in the South, in some cases, tried to pass laws to get black people to stay put, because where else were they going to get cheap labor if they lost the disenfranchised, discriminated against African American population who had no choice but to work for next to nothing? We know from historical records that the African Americans who left the South over the course of the Great Migration, they came from a whole range of socioeconomic backgrounds. But as it got on toward the 1950s, as we were several decades into that migration, the people who by then were leaving tended to be those who were at the higher end of the spectrum, tended to be those who had the benefit of education, who had the means to seek out and have a hope of getting new jobs in new states that they were going to move to. And education offered a way out. And a lot of Americans who had that, who were well-educated and who knew they would have reasonably good prospects if they could get themselves to elsewhere in this country with less discrimination, a lot of those people left because they could. But some of them stayed. And one of those people who definitely had the means to leave and the prospects to leave, but who stayed instead, was this man, Mr. Medgar Evers. He was born in Mississippi in 1925. Medgar Evers served in World War II. After the war, right around the time that he turned 30, Mr. Evers tried to attend the law school at the University of Mississippi at Ole Miss. But Ole Miss was not yet integrated, and the school turned him down on the basis of his race. He then became the first field secretary in his state for the NAACP, and at that time, that was a job that was not some kind of metaphor for bravery. It was the soul of bravery. Right at the outset of Mr. Evers' work in Mississippi, a 14-year-old boy was kidnapped off the porch of a store in a town called Money, Mississippi. He was taken, supposedly, in retaliation for him whistling or flirting or maybe just speaking to a woman who was white. The kid, Emmett Till, was black, and he was 14 years old, and he was tortured and then shot, and then his body was dumped into the Tallahatchie River. When local law enforcement hesitated to prosecute anybody for the murder, it was Medgar Evers who took it upon himself to investigate that crime personally. The woman whom Medgar Evers married, Merle Evers, says that her husband dressed in disguise when he was doing that investigation. He dressed as a field hand on his trips to go try to collect evidence for that crime. He was known to drive 100 miles an hour to get safely out of town and to try to shake anybody who was following him. That was what it took to be the field secretary for the NAACP in Mississippi in 1955. Medgar Evers was brave like that. He worked for voting rights in Mississippi before there was a Voting Rights Act, when registering to vote or trying to vote meant risking your life. And it particularly meant risking your life if you were trying to persuade others that they should register, that they should vote. Mr. Evers led boycotts of businesses that would not hire black workers or treat black customers equally. When Mississippians decided to try to integrate their lunch counters by just sitting down at one no matter what, just taking what was rained down on them for doing it, Medgar Evers made that protest possible in some major ways. He organized that sit-in at the Woolworth lunch counter in 1963. Medgar Evers is just one of those key Americans who at a key time in our country was willing to upset the way things had been so he could get everybody to the way things ought to be. He saw that as possible in the very difficult place where he lived in his very difficult own time.
Now, for many of us who've gone overseas, we fought for this country, we fought for Mississippi, we fought for Alabama, we fought for North Carolina, we fought for Illinois, and we fought for every state in this union. Now, we're going to stay here and see that the things that the mayor has said become a reality.
Medgar Evers stayed in Jim Crow, Mississippi, although he could have left. It's not that it was wrong to leave, but he felt that for him it would be wrong to leave. And so that is where he was. He was in Mississippi 50 years ago today, 50 years ago tonight. 50 years ago was the day that Alabama's governor stood in the door at the University of Alabama and blocked the door with his body so that African-American students could not come in. It was the day that President Kennedy pleaded with the nation for a Civil Rights Act, 50 years ago today. And 50 years ago tonight, just after midnight, with the Woolworths mob still fresh in the headlines, and the reports of the Alabama governor in the schoolhouse door and President Kennedy making that speech on civil rights, with those reports not yet published in the morning papers, after midnight, 50 years ago, Medgar Evers was killed. Mr. Evers was gunned down in his driveway in Jackson, Mississippi, as he pulled up to the house after an NAACP meeting ran late. The Evers had taught their three kids to drop to the floor at the sound of gunfire. And after they heard the shots that night and they hit the floor, they got up and they opened the door, and there was Medgar Evers, husband, father, dying. His car keys were still in his hand, along with a stack of T-shirts that said, "Jim Crow must go." There was no conviction in his murder for another 30 years. Medgar Evers was never as famous as Martin Luther King or Rosa Parks or Malcolm X. They did make the Evers home into a museum not long ago. And if you want, you can go there, you can stand in the driveway, you can see it for yourself. The locals just ask that you be respectful. You are visiting a place where a family lived. A few months ago in Mississippi, Medgar Evers' widow, now Merle Evers Williams, she talked about her husband's decision to stay in Mississippi, knowing at the time what could happen to him. She said, quote, "He always said, Mississippi is my home. I love the place where I was born, and I will do whatever I have to do to make it the best place in the United States of America. He would say to me, Mississippi is going to be the best place in the country. And I told him, you have to be out of your mind. There is no way Mississippi can become anything better than what it is, and quite honestly, I do not want any part of it, and I do not know how you can do what you do." And he said, "Because it is the state of my birth, and I believe in it." And he gave his life, not wanting to die, but he gave it gladly to help lift this state to where it is today. End quote. For Medgar Evers, he decided that Mississippi was worth staying in when so many other people were leaving, staying in and dying in. I think it was much harder for his family to accept his decision after what happened to him. And after his death, they left Mississippi. They joined the Great Migration, in a sense, and they stayed away from the state for a long, long time. But last year, Medgar Evers' widow returned to Jackson after decades away. She returned to Jackson not just for a visit, but to live and to run the Medgar and Merle Evers Institute in Jackson, Mississippi. This week, for the 50th anniversary of his death, they unveiled new portraits of the two of them, the young Medgar Evers, who was, of course, outlived by his ideas, and the present day, Merle Evers Williams, who's trying to carry those ideas forward, including in the place where her late husband was most determined to see them take hold. Sometimes history feels very far away, but sometimes history comes back close enough to touch.
Tri-Family Channel, Tri-Family Channel, oh.
We are back live with the Tougaloo Nine members, Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. and Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, celebrating the 60th anniversary of the Tougaloo Nine as they, on March 27th, 1961, stepped into that Jim Crow library. And you can hear what Rachel Maddow's show had to cover in that period. And just like a lot of historical references back in that time period, they jumped from the restaurants to the marches, and somehow March 27th gets skipped over. I don't know if it's by happenstance or by design, but right here live on Tribe Family Channel, we honor 27th, 1961, and the courage of the Tougaloo Nine. Mr. Jackson, give us words, please, because I know Belzoni, Mississippi goes way back with the Jacksons.
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for that bit of history that took me back to Belzoni, but fast-forwarding, it brought me up to 2014 when me and my son were participants in the annual Medgar Evers Parade in Jackson, Mississippi. So
wow,
that clip that you just played, which I've never heard before. I mean, I want to thank you for that bit of history and that research. But when I heard the name Belzoni, Mississippi, it was difficult for me to be able to listen to that name, because Belzoni, Mississippi was the birthplace of my mother, Beatrice Jackson. And I remember every summer, especially at the age of 10 or 11, she would take me to visit my grandmother and my great-grandmother, who was a former slave. Her name was Belle Jones. And this particular summer, on our way back to Memphis on the Greyhound bus, Clarksville, Mississippi was the midway stop for the bus to allow the passengers to have lunch or to use the restroom or just really to be able to stretch their legs. And on our way back to boarding the Greyhound bus, I don't know what was said, but this Greyhound bus driver turns around and hits my mother in the face and knocks her down onto the gravel road. At that time, they had gravel covering over the road. And so when I turned my mother over, her face was just full of blood. Mm-hmm. And once I was able to wipe her face and to lift her up, I knew I had no legal recourse, really, to legally had enough energy, enough clout to deal with the Jim Crow laws that existed in Memphis Tennessee. Nothing. I felt helpless. As we boarded that Greyhound bus and knowing your place in terms of knowing you better go right on back the way you've become socialized in doing, the back of the bus. And as the bus really pulled off of the pavement from Clarksdale, Mississippi, all the while I was just seething. I was just angry. And that really was the genesis of my civil rights activism. So that is what I remember whenever I hear the city named Belzoni, Mississippi, which is in the Delta, I might add. And that's the poorest region in Mississippi. Mrs. Hollis knows about that because she really is from Mississippi. that's what Belzoni, the name Belzoni, really conjures up into my psychic.
Mm-hmm. How does it feel to you, and then we'll have Mrs. Hollis respond, but when you heard Megar Evers' voice, and knowing that you all now carry the baton and continue his voice and message to those of us who will listen and learn and pass on history so that we can know why we do what we're doing and why it's so important to continue with the work, especially at a time like this when voting suppression is active and successfully passing laws, and we know that Megar Evers gave his life so that Black people would have the right to vote. So could you expound on that, and then we'll have Mrs. Hollis follow suit with her words.
Yeah, proudly, because he did give his life fighting for the right to vote for his people in Jackson, Mississippi. And it is an honor and a privilege for me to be able to be alive, especially in these turbulent times with the resurrection of Jim Crow, to be able to speak out against the recent voter suppression legislation limiting the voting opportunities for people of color. And so I feel proud and honored because I know that this is what he gave his life for, and I really cannot do less. And I just posted, Ms. Black, because
overcome We shall overcome technical difficulty. I don't know what interrupted our show, but we are back, and I have Mr. Jackson ready to continue. Go ahead, Mr. Jackson.
Yes, as I was saying, I was, 23 years old when me and my colleague staged the read-in in the library 60 years ago. And because Medgar really gave his life fighting for his people to have the right to vote, I thought that with the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act and the 1965 Voting Rights Act, I thought that we had defeated Jim Crow. But now, fast forward to March the 25th, 2021, I was really mistaken about having thoughts that Jim Crow had been laid to rest. Then on that day, finding out that voter suppression Jim Crow legislation, which was signed into law by the Georgia governor, Mr. Brian Kemp, with possibly 11 or 12 white men standing over him under a picture of the Callaway plantation, I realized that Jim Crow is still alive and well in the year of 2021. So I just want to remind us as black people that we're still in the struggle trying to secure our right to vote. And I just want to say that we must remain vigilant and get this unjust law overturned in the courts, and we shall overcome.
Amen, amen, amen to that. Mrs. Hollis.
Yes.
The same to you. After hearing what Rachel Maddow's show conveyed and hearing Megger Evers' voice and all of that history, and then, of course, any words that you want to add, and then we're going to take another clip.
That was awesome. It was just amazing to hear the historical year-by-year process and lack of growth and things that went on just with Megger, to see where he started from, what he was up against, and what he was able to accomplish. And I can say that I knew him as a person, not just as a mentor, because he was that kind of a person. He interacted with us for different things because he had so many things going on, and he pulled all of us. He was a person that helped us to be involved in the civic arena, even for getting me to go to Washington, D.C. That was after the sitting and the read-in. But to be able to have me to go there and to be a person that could speak on what was happening in Mississippi and what I had been involved in, that was really, that's how he groomed us to understand what it was about, what we really need to do. So that's on Megger. Megger, I'm so glad that you played that, because I'm like Joseph, there are many things that we have not heard. And it's not that it is not there, it's that we have not been able to have it known to us. And that's what is affecting so many of us as people, we really do not know our history. We do not know the challenges that have come upon people who have made a difference already. We can hear about the ones who do wrong things, but what about the people that are doing the right things? What about grooming people so that they can be able to move forward? And what you, that Joseph said in the end, is that they don't want us to move forward. And we can see that. We are people depended on for centuries to enliven their security and their financial lifestyle. So right now, the progress that happened in Georgia, I know we're talking about Mississippi, but what happened in Georgia really opened up the flames of discontent and wrongdoings. And it was righted by the fact that people went out and they pulled people in and let them know that we can do this if we all make it work for ourselves. As people, we need to encourage. We need to be encouraged to step forward. And I think that's what we did as the 209. We showed people that if you step up towards what you want, basically, and somehow you will be able to get what you need, not just what you want. But you see, right now, my whole point is to be enlightening to so many young people and adults that I come in contact with, and to let them know that the word enlightened for me is just to give them something that they can look forward as a flame to know that you don't have to stand still. You do not have to be made to be burned out like a match that's been struck and burned. You can keep a flame going because you have what it takes. That's a mind, a body, and you also have a soul. People, we are not supposed to be just those type of people that buy things. We should be people that manufacture things. If we can't manufacture them, be able to teach them, be able to mentor them, be able to be somebody that encourages and uplift others, because that's the only way we're going to get out of this quagmire of being subservient. Now, when money comes in, and I want to say it where people can hear and know, when you get the money, our people, the main thing we do, we go and spend it, buy everything that has everybody's name on it. Now, if it had Mega's name, Mega Ever's name on it, that would be a good thing. If it had your own name on it, that would be an even better thing. But when we don't realize what this country is doing for us, it's economical, but it is not for us if we don't know what economics is, the main drawback. People don't want us to advance because what we've been doing, we've been advancing other people while we've been putting ourselves down. And we can't do that unless we have knowledge. And we can't have knowledge unless we've been taught. And we can't be taught if we don't have those episodes and things that are teaching for us to learn these things. And I'm saying that because that's what Voices of Wisdom was about, and that's why you started it, and that's why we stayed with it, and that's why we're still content with speaking up when we need to be spoken. It's not about how pretty I look. It's about how my mind is working. And I would like to let everybody know that you don't have to be in the situation that you're in, but you've got to learn to move around being pretty and being somebody else's, what do you call them, when you wear other folks' clothes or when you wear other folks' things that they're doing. Wear your own.
Billboard.
Make
your
own. You can be an entrepreneur. Just like we learn to read. One reason I go to the library and to find out things now. I might not go into the library, but I'm searching for things, for more knowledge, because the more knowledge I get, the more I can learn. And the more I learn, the more I can know. And if you don't do anything but entertain yourself, you're not going to learn a lot.
Oh, Lord, have mercy. Ladies and gentlemen, live on Tribe Family Channel, we are honoring the 60th anniversary of the Tougaloo Nine. They walked into that Jackson, Mississippi, whites-only library system on March 27, 1961, and the rest is history. In fact, 60 years of history. Now, I'm going to play this clip. It is 1 minute and 12 seconds long. It is titled, Tougaloo Nine Sit-In. I don't know what it says. So here we go, and then we're going to come right back live on Tribe Family Channel with our final words after this.
Of the sit-in was to break down the barriers of segregation. And my mentor, Medgar Evers, who was the first national field NAACP field secretary. The NAACP is the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. And it was his job to break down those barriers of segregation with regards to not being able to attend all-white facilities that had signs designated whites only. And so our purpose was to eliminate the barriers of Jim Crow.
All right. We are live back on Tribe Family Channel, and that was no doubt sounding like the voice of Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. from a clip.
Yes, and just a bit of history in terms of what Ms. Hollis is saying is that we must teach our family and others the importance of really continuing the struggle for our civil rights as black people. That was my first interview with my 18 or 19 year old granddaughter. Her name is Victoria Ann Jackson. And that is the first interview that I have ever had with anyone else. She was the first, my great granddaughter. And
wow.
That is the background of that clip.
Wow. History, history, history. And that does piggyback right off of Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, because it is very important to teach the history. And you have definitely done that by bridging the gap with the generations going to your great-granddaughter, Victoria Ann Jackson, did you say?
Right.
That's absolutely wonderful. Now, I want to give you all, your just due. I want to thank you for taking the time out to know me and to trust me with your voices, your brand, your history, and just your media voice when it comes to being host on Voices of Wisdom, meeting people, telling your story, continuing to bridge the gap, enlightening our minds and empowering our youth, being on social media, continuing to empower the world of the knowledge of what it took to do what you did then and what it's going to continue to take, what is necessary to do now. We're going to have to get in good trouble. We're going to have to protect our right to vote. We're going to have to step out boldly and unafraid and unapologetic about not only voters' rights, but human rights. It is absolutely inhuman. And the messaging and the optics have a purpose to sign voter suppression laws into place beneath images that depict a Jim Crow or an era of the enslavement of our people, a plantation. That right there tells you the psyche, the mentality, and the thought processes, because you, that's not happenstance. That is a decision having been considered and affirmed, and there they sat. So there we go. That's our message from them to us. Now you know what type of fight you're in, because they prefer you'd still be on the plantation and they wouldn't have to be dealing with you wanting to have a voice and vote. But that's just my two cents before I get wound up in here, because we know I can. So ladies and gentlemen, I want to just thank you for tuning in to this 60th anniversary celebration of the Tougaloo Nine and hearing words from two of the actual nine who courageously and selflessly forged into that Jim Crow whites-only library. And like Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. said, they didn't have time to think about their life. Why? Because they were thinking about ours. So they want their roses while they can smell them. And I would encourage you to visit them on their website. And I want to give them the opportunity to have these final words before we play the outro songs that encourage the moment that we're in. I want to thank you for tuning in. I am Beverly Black. This is Tribe Family Channel, www.tribefamilychannel.com. And in closing, I want to say ladies first. Mrs. Geraldine Hollis, what are your final words, and where on the web can we reach you?
Thank you very much. I appreciate you so much. Since I've met you those years past, not too long, but long enough to know that you
are a
person that really wants to uplift the community and people, and that you really do like to share and let people know what they can do to be a better person and a better image of themselves. And you've written that in your book, too.
Oh, well, thank you so very much.
That we can go from one place to the other, but we have to know that we have to want that. Nobody's going to give us anything, actually. They will give us things that they don't want, but the things that we want, we have to work for them. We have to study for them. And even though we are the Tougaloo Nine representing here, I want you to know that I continue to lift up people by, even though it's been COVID, I do Zoom and those kinds of online presentations to schools, universities, colleges, nonprofits, to whomever calls. More than likely, I've been able to get with them and to be able to enlighten them on why and what and how we can move forward in our lives. Nobody is able to hold us down. If we are willing to move forward, it means that we can struggle, but we still can do that. When we walked into that library, we had to be prepared. We didn't just go in there. We had to be prepared physically, mentally, emotionally, and not so much financially, but we knew that we had to know that we had to put out some money. Somebody had to put out some money because we were jailed, and we had to pay a fine. Thankfully, the college and Megar Evers, those people had that taken care of for us. But we still have the residuals of being jailed for making something right. And I encourage all of the young people and people in general, do not lay down on your rights. Lift yourself up first and try to make it a life worth living. And in order to do that, That means you have to change your attitude about life. That's about what I have to say. Thank you so much. And thank you, Joseph, for being a part of this. As usual, thank you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, Mrs. Geraldine Hollis. And I appreciate your sacrifice, your kind words, and your acknowledgement. It means so much to me. And I love you, Queen. And we will always be connected. So thank you so very much for also introducing me to Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr., who we will turn the floor over to. And then we will, oh, Mrs. Hollis, where can people reach you? You have a website, you have books out.
Actually, just Google my name or my book, Back to Mississippi, and you'll find a lot of things, or a lot to look at. And you can order the books on Amazon. Right now I'm in the process of probably redoing my book, and the website that I have, which is Back to Mississippi, may not be so much there anymore, but Back to Mississippi, just in terms of Googling it, you can find a lot of things. And you can find the book online, almost all over where online books are sold. And just Google my name and you'll find a lot about me. Almost too much, if I must say so.
Well, if you definitely go to Amazon, you are definitely going to find Mrs. Geraldine Hollis. She is a phenomenal author, and, you know, with your books being available, March Memories, A True Reflection of Time Then and Now, and also Back to Mississippi, Sidewalks represent a journey to the path of my success. Follow my steps and take the journey. So, ladies and gentlemen, her books are available on Kindle. And, you know, we support the authors. So if you buy the paperback or Kindle, we definitely want to read that history and ingest. And follow her on Facebook. So like she said, Google her and you will find her. Now, Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr., who I also know happens to be affiliated with the World Wide Web, and I understand he has a wealth of information about the trailer that we just heard at the beginning of the show and different things. So also, the Tougaloo 9 has T-shirts out. So, Mr. Jackson, please give us your final words and where people can find you on the web and know about any upcoming events, news, and these amazing T-shirts. By the way, many of us are wearing our Tougaloo 9 T-shirt today, and there are several or a couple of varieties available. But I think that they're phenomenal in the sense that they bring out the essence of your sacrifice. I want to thank you again for doing what you did. And so go ahead, Mr. Jackson, and close out the show. And thank you for, again, your sacrifice and courage.
Well, first and foremost, my role model as a minister was Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., who was assassinated in the city of my birth, which was Memphis, Tennessee. My mentor and my civil rights leader was Mr. Medgar Wiley Evers, who was assassinated in the city of Jackson, Mississippi, which I attended Tougaloo Southern Christian College as a ministerial student. For both of these men, they have a significant meaning to me, a connection, because both of these men were considered to be servant leaders. I have to emphasize that they were servant leaders. And that is what I consider myself to be, a servant leader. And it's just ironic that when Medgar pulled his Oldsmobile up to the house after having worked late, the things that he decided to take into the house before he was assassinated, there were T-shirts that were being sold by the NAACP and emblazoned on the front of the T-shirts were the words, Jim Crow must go. And now, on the 60th anniversary, I'm selling T-shirts. And those that are being worn by the contributors of keeping the story of the Tougaloo Nine alive, I myself have been blessed by God to be able to proudly pay for those T-shirts with the mugshot emblazoned on the front of the T-shirt. And I believe the statement on the back is the nine who stood up so that we may sit down. And so both of the men that inspired me to be involved in this continuous struggle for our civil rights, that is what I continue to sacrifice my life for. It's for my people. And I do believe that being called to the ministry is my purpose. And I just want to leave my people, now that we know that we are still in the struggle for our civil rights, I'm going to leave them with the speech of a great black hero, and his name is Frederick Douglass. And Frederick Douglass says, if there is no struggle, there is no progress. So I want to say to my people, stay in the struggle, and we shall overcome.
All right.
Thank you so very much, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you to the two members here of the Tougaloo Nine for making your presence felt and known with your words of wisdom and your sage knowledge on this 60th anniversary celebration of the Tougaloo Nine. You can tune in at www.thetougaloo9.com to reach Mr. Joseph Jackson Jr. His management company will be in touch with you if you contact Medium to request any Zoom or telephone interviews. And like Mrs. Geraldine Hollis said, you can reach her, Google her. She is available. And she also continues to maintain the Voices of Wisdom page on Facebook, which is the home of the radio show that these two so eloquently for many years hosted and have spoke with many people, all the way from Martin Luther King Jr.'s family to Emmett Till's family to curators of the Dr. King papers at Stanford and everyone in between. So again, I want to thank you. I salute you. It's an honor and a privilege knowing you. God bless you. I stand on your shoulders, and I love you. God bless you, and good night.
Good night.
Don't need no baggage, you just get on board. All you need is faith to hear the dealer's honking. Don't need no ticket, you just thank the Lord. So people get ready for the train. Family Channel.